President Obama prepares to say goodbye today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Barack Obama gives his farewell address in Chicago this evening. Some will miss him, especially in Kenya, the birthplace of his father.
Just by having Obama as the president, Kenya had been recognized. People will still be talking about Obama here for many years to come.
Also, a plea for the Trump administration to be wary of Vladimir Putin.
This is not a Democrat. This is not someone who believes in human rights or in liberal values.
Plus, on the trail of some hot contraband in Mexico.
Off to the side of the road, this car is parked. The trunk is open. It's glowing. And inside, there's 40 boxes of beautiful Krispy Kreme donuts.
Don't tell my doctor, but I'll take a dozen. That's ahead today on The World. Thank you for being here. It's a busy news day today. In Washington, the spotlight was on Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, President-elect Trump's pick for attorney general. His confirmation hearing kicked off today, and there will be hearings on Capitol Hill all this week for a slew of other Trump nominees, including Rex Tillerson, the oil executive nominated to be Secretary of State. We'll hear more about him and his Russia connections later on the show. We begin, though, with the man who is still president for another 10 days. Barack Obama will be giving his farewell address tonight in Chicago. But we want to talk right now about another kind of parting shot from President Obama, an article he's just written for the journal Science. Kind of unusual for a sitting president to publish in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. The World's Carolyn Beeler joins me to talk about this. So Donald Trump, a climate change denier, is about to take office. His pick for EPA is also a climate change denier. And here's Obama writing an article for Science. So aside from being a political message of sorts, how does this article play into Obama's scientific legacy?
Well, two things. I think it can be seen as a last push to sell his climate change policies to both experts in the field and to President-elect Trump. In the article, Obama makes a really targeted argument about the economic benefits of cutting carbon emissions and investing in renewable energy. He mentions Trump by name in the last paragraph of the paper, and it's an argument that seems really tailor-made to appeal to a Republican Congress and a Republican businessman president-elect. The other point I'd like to make about Obama's scientific legacy is that this is a reminder of the role that science and scientific advisors have played during Obama's tenure.
Yeah, what role has science played in the Obama White House?
It's played a relatively large role. The president's top scientific advisor, John Holdren, is thought to have had President Obama's ear more than any other White House science advisor, at least in recent history. Holdren played a major role in developing the president's climate change policies, which were obviously a hallmark of his tenure. And Holdren's Office of Science and Technology Policy is seen as having been a very active iteration of that office. During Obama's two terms in office, he came up with a bunch of big scientific initiatives, including the Precision Medicine Initiative, the Cancer Moonshot Initiative, and the Brain Initiative, which funneled a huge amount of funding into Alzheimer's research.
It seems kind of remarkable, a sitting president to have an article published in this top scientific journal. Is Obama the first one?
Yes, he is. The editors of Science say they've scoured their records and haven't been able to find any other presidents who have written articles for them. Interestingly, other heads of state have, including Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany. Prince Albert of Monaco has also written something for the journal.
And why do you think Obama was aiming to publish this in a scientific journal rather than, say, on the op-ed pages of the New York Times?
Well, there's a joke going around that he's angling for tenure at some sort of academic institution because in recent days he's also published articles in the New England Journal of Medicine and the Harvard Law Review.
Ah, so what's up with that?
So this is sort of what seems to be a last coordinated effort to try to push forward the policies that he has made and enshrine his legacy. So, for example, in the New England Journal of Medicine, he was defending the Affordable Care Act and asking Congress not to repeal it without providing an alternative.
Can we make an assumption that people in the scientific community will see more legitimacy in what Obama says than somebody who is not as sciencey?
Well, I think it's key that these are peer-reviewed journals. So, you know, experts in their field look at what he's saying and validate that they're accurate and he's gone through the right steps to get his information. And so I think he's really saying this is a source you can trust.
So with Obama putting himself in the academic intellectual box with these articles and scientific journals, he's leaving, and Trump, who's a populist and calling climate change a hoax, is coming in. What is the scientific community thinking going forward?
I think they're afraid of the uncertainty. The White House impacts science and health research in a lot of ways, including influencing where a huge amount of research funding goes. And there's also the question of how much science will play into decisions that are made in the Oval Office. And the scientific community is looking for a president who takes the advice of scientists and experts very seriously and weighs that heavily in making decisions. And I think the scientific community is not convinced that's what they have in a president-elect Trump.
The World's Carolyn Beeler. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Marco.
8 years ago, Barack Obama hadn't been sworn in as president yet, and the excitement was mounting around the globe ahead of his inauguration. But in one country, that excitement bordered on hysteria. Kenya, the birthplace of President Obama's father. People there thought of the new president as one of their own. That's how my BBC colleague Michael Kaloki in Nairobi remembers it.
Kenya was literally swept up in this phrase that was coined Obamamania. Mm. And election night, you know, in 2008 may as well have been election night here in Kenya. People stayed up late night to watch coverage of the voting after he was announced the winner. It was a huge sense of jubilation here. I was watching local television at the time, and I remember some people saying how exciting it was to have a Kenyan as president in the White House. I mean, that was really what some people felt. And the government here even declared a public holiday after his win. And some children who were born around that time were even named Obama by their parents.
So 8 years later, how do Kenyans feel?
I think over the period of his first term, there was some sense of perhaps a bit of disappointment that there wasn't that strong connection they felt that they had expected when he was voted in. And then in his second term, there was a sense that maybe things would change. But then again, there was this sense that, oh, maybe it just didn't work as many people had thought it would. However, there was a sense of relief maybe when he visited the country in 2015. And he you know, spoke to Kenyans at the time and expressed his feelings to the country. And I think his visit perhaps was a sense of healing for some who may have felt that he might have ignored Kenya during his term as president. But there was also a sense then that just by having Obama as the president, that Kenya had been recognized. And there were some indications that even there was perhaps some increase in tourists who were coming to Kenya just because there was this link between Kenya and Obama.
You know, a lot of critics of George W. Bush faulted him for the Iraq War, but they always did cite his attention to Africa, especially through PEPFAR, his program to combat HIV/AIDS. If you had to give Obama a report card, or any of your Kenyan friends were to, what would you say Obama did for Kenya when he was president?
Well, that was a question that, you know, many people have been asking over the years, is what has he done for Kenya, for the region, for the continent? And as you indicated there, some have said that Mr. Bush did quite a bit for the continent, recognizing the challenges it was facing. Now, in terms of President Obama, some commentators here, economists, talking about that Obama perhaps could have paid a little bit more attention to the region and tried to boost trade and cooperation in a much firmer, better, effective way than he has done. However, there are some who feel that his administration, although perhaps not giving direct attention to the continent, has helped put it in the world map.
There is still a lot of love for Obama. I read that in the village of Kogelo, the hometown of Obama's father, Barack Sr., there are pictures of him in nearly every home. Is there hope in Kenya that Obama will, in his role as former president, will visit, maybe even double down on a commitment to Kenya?
Well, you know, once he leaves office, there's this feeling that he might come back to the country, but then he will not be president. He will be visiting perhaps in his private capacity. And if he does visit, I mean, people will be happy. People will be glad to have Obama, who some have called the son of Kenya, back in the country. But then there'll also perhaps be others who will be asking, well, when he was in office, couldn't he perhaps have done more for Kenya? But once again, you know, we have had other voices in the country saying that maybe the country shouldn't be too attached to him because he is not the Kenyan leader. He is the American leader.
I suspect that when Kenyans visit the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, they're going to miss seeing his picture on the wall.
Well, I should say that, it's perhaps some people will. You still see his picture, for example, on matatus here in Kenya. I know, Marco, you've been on
the taxis.
I've seen matatus here, the local public taxis, and some of them are called Obama and they have his picture on them. And I think his memories and just what Obama means for Kenyans will still remain for a long time, and people will still be talking about Obama here for many years to come.
My colleague at BBC Nairobi, Michael Kaloki. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to some lighter news, though no less controversial. FIFA, the world governing body for soccer, has decided to expand the format of the Men's World Cup tournament. Bear with me if your thoughts are still on that nail-biter finish to the Clemson-Alabama game last night. So right now, with what the rest of the world calls football, 32 teams can qualify for the World Cup tournament. You'll remember it's held every 4 years. And starting with the 2026 edition, the number of teams will go up to 48. I think it's fair to say soccer fans around the globe are split on the value of this expansion. The world soccer guy William Troop joins me in the studio. First of all, William, for us here in the U.S., with a soccer program that has been looking darn presentable on the world stage, why is this important?
Well, it potentially could make the job of qualifying for the World Cup a little easier if the qualifying system still works the way it is and more teams make it. That could mean more spots for North American teams like the U.S., so that could be a plus for the U.S. The other thing, though, is that we're talking about these changes coming into effect in 2026 when we don't know who's going to host the World Cup. And one of the countries in the running is the U.S. So potentially this could mean more World Cup games being played on U.S. soil in 2026.
So it could be a good thing for Team USA. But generally, what do you think about the plan? What's better, 32 teams or 48 teams?
Well, personally, I thought 32 was just right. Expanding it to 48 means that you're obviously going to bring in 16 more teams to a World Cup tournament. And that means some teams that are maybe not as good as the current crop of 32 that make it to the World Cup are going to be allowed into the tournament. So what does that mean? I hope it doesn't mean that the quality of the soccer being played goes down. It could mean that there's more drama, because there will be more opportunities for Cinderella teams to make a run in a tournament that they otherwise wouldn't even be at. Mm. It kind of makes me think of March Madness and, you know, college basketball. And it could be more exciting.
Why is FIFA doing this? And please tell me it's not all about more money.
I cannot discount that it's not about more money, because that is certainly part of it. You know, more games televised, more countries televising them. That will certainly make the revenue from TV rights go up. So that is an issue. But really, it's about politics. Asia and Africa are two continents that have been complaining for years that they've been discriminated against, because they have a lot of countries with national soccer teams and only a few spots at each World Cup.
You agree with those critiques?
I think that's fair. I mean, the expansion of the World Cup historically, it has happened before, is all about being more inclusive, letting more countries that are not from South America or from Europe, the two hotbeds of soccer historically, to be represented at the tournament.
So for you, William, super fan, what's the bottom line?
There's going to be more games to watch during the World Cup. Every time there's a World Cup going on, I try to watch all of the games. And if there's 80 games in 1 month, I'm not sure I can watch them all. I'm really worried about this, but I'm going to try.
Well, start programming the TiVos and hard drives. The world's one-man soccer desk. William Troop, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Still ahead, along the U.S.-Mexico border, a black market for glazed donuts. True story, coming up on The World. How many times a day are you asked for an ID? Maybe if you get carded at a bar or when you cash a check. Routine for most of us, but if you're undocumented, you have no valid ID, and those scenarios are anxiety-provoking. Some U.S. cities issue IDs, regardless of immigration status. New York City is one of them, but the city is now under fire from critics who say that's a major safety issue. The world's Jasmine Garz has more from New York.
I meet Ana Maria at a church in Staten Island. She asks that her last name not be used. She tells me one of the first things she did when she got her New York City ID card was go to the library, get books, information. That's very important to me. Ana Maria says she checks out CDs and magazines to practice her English, but she also checks out poetry in Spanish. She says she really likes this poet. She can't remember his name. He's from Mexico, like her, and he writes about hummingbirds. Ana Maria is an undocumented immigrant, and she can't use her ID to drive. For her, it's nice to have access to those books in the library, like other New Yorkers. For her friend, Araceli, The ID means a lot more.
Pero no nos permiten pasar por lo mismo de que...
Araceli is also undocumented. She says before, she couldn't go to PTA meetings at her kid's school. They required an ID to let her in because of terrorism threats and mass shootings. Now, with the ID, she can come and go freely. It's helped her develop a closer relationship with teachers, something that she says helped save her life. When her ex-husband's beatings started getting more severe, one teacher said she needed to call the police. Araceli says the ID made her feel safer about doing that, less worried about having to prove who she was. And she says if she needs to call the police, now they know where she lives, who she is. But the New York ID is under fire. Critics say giving people unauthorized to live here access to bank accounts, schools, is dangerous. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio disagrees. He and immigration advocates say it's about bringing people out of the shadows. De Blasio promises to destroy the records of undocumented immigrants who've applied for an ID, to protect them from being targeted by immigration officials. Doing that, some say, threatens cities' safety.
So our concern is if you're giving out government-issued identification cards, if there were to be an investigation or there were judicial inquiries into cardholders, then all the records would have not be there anymore to be able to satisfy those requests.
Assemblywoman Nicole Malatakis represents Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. She's one of the two Republican lawmakers suing the city to not destroy the records of people who've applied for the ID.
If you do a Google search for fake passport, you'll see countless stories. You know, this is not something we're just making up, trying to scare people. I mean, this is a legitimate thing. The Berlin attacker had 14 different identifications.
El ID es un arma de dos filos.
Ana Maria, the undocumented immigrant, says she's worried now. Will the ID in her purse get her deported from the U.S.?
This is our city. A lot of people here have been living in New York for 20, 30 years.
Fabio Ramirez Caminati runs El Centro, New York City, an immigrant rights group in Staten Island. He's telling immigrants the ID is good. Get one.
They work here. Their children study here. They pay taxes here, and this is our city.
Documented or not, the ID is about living here, like anyone else, he says. But now some immigrants here wonder whether getting that ID at all might cause them more trouble in the end. For The World, Jasmine Garzd in New York.
A little confession here. I grew up about five blocks from the Krispy Kreme factory in Raleigh, North Carolina. And for late night fat and sugar consumption, it was the place to go. A glazed Krispy Kreme or several hit the spot like nothing else. Thanks to cholesterol, I can't do that anymore, but I totally get this next story. The black market for Krispy Kremes along the U.S.-Mexico border that's popped up in the border towns of El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, Mexico. Better known as transit points for guns and drugs and now donuts. LA Times reporter Kate Linthicum describes the scene this way.
The addicts pull up just after nightfall near a sedan parked along a busy street in this border city known best for murder. One by one, they fork over fistfuls of cash to Sonia Garcia, who reaches into the trunk of her car and hands over the trafficked goods.
Kate Linthicum joins us from Mexico City. You set the scene very nicely, Kate. So the addicts are people who love donuts and, I assume, the trafficked goods in the trunk of Sonia's car, donuts, right?
Exactly. So it's a dark night in Juarez. Cars passing quickly on this major thoroughfare. And off to the side of the road, this car is parked. The trunk is open, it's glowing, and inside there's 40 boxes of beautiful Krispy Kreme donuts.
So Sonia Garcia is the woman behind this donut operation. What is the Krispy Kreme Familia?
So the Krispy Kreme Familia, which I think not coincidentally sounds like it could be a Mexican drug cartel, is a family that every day crosses the border into El Paso, where there is a Krispy Kreme store, buys about 40 boxes of donuts, and then drives them back into Juarez, where there isn't a Krispy Kreme store, and sells them to a very, very willing audience.
So we're calling this a black market, but is it really illegal? Like, what happens if she crosses the border and the police see many dozens of donuts in her trunk? What are they going to do?
It hasn't happened yet, and the family pretty much wanted to avoid that question.
Oh, right.
What happened is in the past, there was a Krispy Kreme store in Juarez, and it closed a few years ago, but the appetite didn't go away. It's also just part of this weird obsession in Mexico with Krispy Kremes that I've noticed since I moved here.
Yeah, so what is the obsession about? Because, I mean, I would put a churro up against a Krispy Kreme, and I think the churro might win.
I'm imagining like a lucha libre match between exactly. the Krispy Kreme and the churro. No, it's true. Mexico does not lack when it comes to fried sugary dough. There's the churro, there's the sopapilla, there's the buñuelo, which is this fritter-like delicious goodness. But Mexico does not do donuts well. I don't know what it is, if it's something in the water or something about the ovens, but they tend to be dry, just not up to American donut standards. So when Krispy Kreme opened here in Mexico in 2004, people went wild. And if you actually get on a flight flying from Mexico City to a more provincial part of the country, you're likely to see like multiple passengers toting boxes of Krispy Kremes for their family.
That is unreal. So can Sonia Garcia really make money doing this?
You know, you can buy it like a, if you're buying in bulk, if you're really buying 40 boxes of donuts in the US, you can get them for about $5 a dozen. In Mexico right now, they're selling for around $8 a dozen. So, you know, that's a modest but real profit there. She's actually doing this to help put one of her sons through engineering school.
Wow.
So there's a sweet side to this story.
Were you able to speak with any people who were buying these Krispy Kremes? Are they like, you know, regulars or mostly one-offs who just hear about, you know, Sonia's car filled with donuts?
No, there's definitely regulars. You know, there's a couple people who come three, maybe four times a week. And then there's the gym employees from across the street where she sells the donuts who have been known to drive up, order a dozen, and then sheepishly, before they leave, ask for a second dozen.
And I suppose when she's done, the trunk is empty.
Yeah, and occasionally she steals a box for herself. She admitted that.
So, Kate, if you had your choice between a Krispy Kreme glaze and a churro with cinnamon sugar, what's your call?
Krispy Kreme all the way. As my mom points out, they have less than 300 calories, so I see it as a very respectable meal replacement option.
LA Times reporter Kate Linthicum in Mexico City. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Back in 1939, Claire Hollingworth had just become a reporter when she broke the story that World War II was about to start.
She was very charming. She was very cunning. She was a great reporter. And, you know, just within 2 weeks of becoming a journalist, she had literally the scoop of the century.
That story coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Confirmation hearings for Rex Tillerson get underway tomorrow on Capitol Hill. So get ready to hear more about Russia's ties to the incoming administration. The former ExxonMobil CEO is President-elect Trump's pick for Secretary of State, and his links with Russia go deep. Back in 2013, Tillerson received the Order of Friendship from Russian President Vladimir Putin. And since then, Exxon's activity in Russia have stalled because of U.S. sanctions, which, according to The Guardian's Luke Harding, means the energy giant has had to forego some big profits.
One of the things that was kind of mothballed was this massive mega project between Exxon and Rosneft to explore the Russian Arctic. Now, Rosneft being the big oil company.
Right.
Now, if sanctions are lifted, if Tillerson does that as a kind of early act of Secretary of State, that's potentially worth probably billions of dollars to Exxon. Exxon already has a kind of joint project with Rosneft on the other side of Russia, on the Pacific, near sort of Vladivostok on Sakhalin Island. And clearly, there's going to be huge financial dividends for Exxon, for its investors, for everybody, if Tillerson lifts sanctions, which he's, as CEO, he said he was opposed to sanctions and he didn't like them much.
Can a congressional hearing kind of glean all this stuff?
A congressional hearing can ask the right questions, but I think it goes to the heart of a kind of bigger problem, which is that there are so many ties between the new administration and Russia, financial ties. And we have some detail, but a lot of this is still kind of very murky. It's very subterranean. We know that Carter Page, important Trump foreign policy aide, has ties with Gazprom, which is the kind of major Russian gas company. We know that Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign manager, who used to work for Viktor Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, has got ties to Russian and Ukrainian oligarchs. And really, there hasn't been a great deal of disclosure. I've tried talking to the oligarchs in Russia. They don't want to talk to me or other journalists. And we simply don't know the depth and the scale of these connections.
A lot has been said about Rex Tillerson's personal ties to Vladimir Putin. One person told us it's Tillerson, Steven Seagal, and Henry Kissinger. That's like the inner circle who gets to speak to Putin. What is your impression of the Putin-Tillerson relationship?
the best sort of defense of Tillerson is that he's a shrewd, tough CEO who unfortunately has to do business with some pretty kind of unattractive leaders who happen to be in countries which are not democratic with large amounts of oil. And that's the way the world kind of works. I mean, I think the kind of counter case is that very few Americans, very few people in general have received the order of friendship from Vladimir Putin. Now, Putin, as we know, is canny. He's ruthless. He's unscrupulous. He would only have done that if he thought that this was not so much in Rex Tillerson's interest, but in Russia's interest and the Kremlin's interest, and in the interest of the powerful cabal of billionaires who surround him, including Igor Sechin, who has a very nice yacht, by the way. And so you might say, actually, this makes Tillerson a good guy to deal with Russia because he understands them. He knows the key players. But you could also say that this compromises him. I mean, how can he take tough decisions which go against Russia's interests when you might say he's kind of in their pocket?
I don't know. Is there an upside to all of this? Is it possible that Rex Tillerson is uniquely situated to kind of realign Washington's relations with Moscow in a way that could work for both countries and create a more stable world?
That's the kind of idealistic view. But also, you just have to look at what's happened. If you believe that the FBI and the CIA and basically all of America's intelligence agencies, Vladimir Putin has just hacked the American election. Now, that may not have caused Trump to win. Trump may have won for other reasons, but it certainly played a role. And I think Putin's broader goal was to destabilize America and to undermine its democracy in the eyes not only of American voters, but also the world more generally. And this is the man who apparently is going to be Donald Trump and Rex Tillerson's new best friend. And you have to ask yourself whether that's actually in U.S. interests. I mean, by all means, have a better relationship with Russia. But at the same time, I think you have to be pretty clear-eyed about the man in charge in Russia, about his methods, which have included murdering people he doesn't like in London, in Europe. Alexander Litvinenko, I've written a book about, who was killed with a radioactive cup of tea in 2006. This is not a Democrat. This is not someone who believes in human rights or in liberal values. And he's also someone, I suspect, who would get everything he can from a better relationship with the U.S. without giving very much in return.
What are your Russia contacts telling you about the kind of reception Tillerson might get in Russia if his nomination is successful?
I think ecstatic. We know that Russian parliamentarians, members of the Duma, were clinking champagne glasses after Trump got elected. I was looking at photos today sent to me by a friend of bookshops in Moscow. The entire front windows are stuffed full of books in Russian and English about Trump, how to emulate Trump. Really, Trump is being seen as a kind of friend of Russia. And I think Tillerson would arrive if he comes to Moscow as Secretary of State to a kind of triumphant reception, at least to begin with.
Luke Harding with The Guardian. Great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
The next Secretary of State is also going to have to focus on the world's refugee crisis. Hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees have made their way to Germany alone in recent years. They've come from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And they've been welcomed in many German towns and cities. But in the former East Germany, where the economy has struggled, that welcome has been less than enthusiastic. One exception is a tiny village near the border with Poland. It's called Gosow. And the world's Matthew Bell paid a visit there just before Christmas.
Tonight, every seat is filled in the little Lutheran church in the center of town. The Christmas concert happens every year, but for two members of the audience, this is something very new. Ahmed and Rasha Haimoud are a married couple, originally from northwestern Syria. They moved to Gosow back in February with their four children. This is their first Christmas in their new hometown. And, unsurprisingly, because they're Muslims, the Haimouds have never spent much time inside a church before. After the performance, Ahmed and Rasha mingle with some of their neighbors. There's an awkward moment when Rasha realizes most of the snacks include pork. They tell me they drive all the way to Berlin twice a week to get halal meat. But they're settling in here. They're both taking German language classes. Rasha hopes to go back to university. Ahmed plans to get work laying tile. They tell me they feel lucky. We are very thankful to Germany, Ahmed tells me, as Rasha translates into German. We came here for the future of our kids, they say. It turns out Golzo is thankful they're here too. The Haimouds are one of three Syrian families who relocated here in the last year. They all have lots of kids, and together, they are helping to save the one place that makes this small village, population 800, kind of famous here. If you mention Golzo, people all over Germany will know about the elementary school here. That's because in 1961, an East German film crew started following a class of first graders. The documentary film project aired on German TV for decades, right up until 2007. It followed the same group of kids into adulthood, starting at Golzo Elementary. But all that notoriety could not save the school from a harsh reality. The former East Germany has been in economic decline, and the population of Golzo had dwindled to the point where it looked like it wouldn't be able to sustain its only elementary school. This is Gabby Thomas, the director of the elementary school. She tells me the problem goes back to the early days after the wall came down. The big agricultural commune here closed. People lost their jobs. Younger folks started moving to the cities, and suddenly there were empty houses all over the village. Last year, there were barely enough kids for a full first-grade class. Thomas says she and the town mayor decided it was clear what they needed to do. Go find some refugee families with school-aged kids to move to Golzo.
So, first you say goodbye, everybody.
Good morning, Mrs.
Just ahead of the holiday break, I visit Gabby Thomas's fourth grade English class. It's full, and that's thanks in part to two girls from Syria. What's your name?
My name is Kamala.
Kamala, nice to meet you. Do you think English is difficult?
Is English schwer for you, Kamala?
Little.
But Thomas tells me the Syrian students are doing very well in school. They've been here less than a year, and they're speaking German with ease. She says a total of 8 Syrian kids helped fill enough seats to keep up enrollment and maintain class sizes. Housing is free for the Syrian families for now. Golzo mayor Frank Schutz says at first, some locals were against the idea of letting Muslim refugees move in, but they've come around.
Wir haben etwas Besonderes in Golzo. Das ist vielleicht auch was Besonderes. Wir haben
Schutz says, we have given these refugees a new home, but they saved our school, and they brought the laughter of children to our village. So really, he says, they have given us more than we have given them. For the World, Matthew Bell, Golzo, Germany.
Back during World War II, the U.S. Army came up with an idea, musicals to entertain the troops. And for the past few days, some of those shows have been performed in New York City for the first time since the war. The venue, a former aircraft carrier docked on the Hudson River, now the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum. The musicals are collectively known as Blueprint Specials. Most of the songs were written by Frank Lesser before he hit fame with Guys and Dolls. Tom Ridgely is the director who brought these musicals back to life.
These were written in 1944 and early 45 as part of a really comprehensive morale-boosting program that the Army was doing during World War II. They recognized that the USO could only get so many places, but they also recognized that the entertainment was really beneficial for the troops, and so they were trying to come up with a way that they could do it themselves. And so they created these blueprints that had scores and scripts and instructions about how to do scenery and costumes, and they would ship those out so that soldiers could, as they say, put up their own shows in a jiffy.
Like choreography instructions?
There are choreographic notes. The choreography for some we know was done by a young Jose Limon.
Right.
And there are drawings and instructions for several of his dances that the Limon Company in 2017 has sort of reconstructed and reimagined based on those and of course their really intimate knowledge of his work.
Now, when these shows were written, Frank Lesser himself was a private. Were there a lot of entertainers in the military in World War II who were able to pull these shows off convincingly?
Yeah, you know, the roster of talent that they had was incredible. In addition to Frank Lesser was Alex North, who later went on to get nominated for 15 Oscars scoring films, and a guy named Arnold Auerbach, who was writing the books, and he went on to become an Emmy-winning television writer for Milton Berle and Phil Silvers and Jackie Gleason. And then of course, there's Lamone himself, who went on to become just a legend in modern dance.
So where did you first come across them?
You know, it's a funny story. I was at home making dinner one night, and the opening song for Guys and Dolls just sort of popped into my head for no particular reason other than it's a really catchy song. And I just found myself thinking, golly, what else did he write? And So I just Googled Frank Lesser, and in his Wikipedia page, there's about a sentence that says, oh, yeah, then he went to the Army and wrote this musical called High Yank for the Army. And that just really surprised me. And so I started trying to track it down. And once I did and saw what it was, that it was this complete blueprint with all these with all this information about what the show was supposed to be, then I knew that it was something pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. So one show like High Yank, I mean, musical plot lines are never especially well honed. What's the plot of High Yank or any of these?
Well, High Yank is about this character called Sad Sack, and he was created by an Army cartoonist, a guy named George Baker, Sergeant George Baker, and went on to have a really robust post-war life. The comic went on for many years. They made a movie starring Jerry Lewis about it, and so this was a really resonant character. So it just sort of follows Sad Sack around and his, you know, sort of Sad Sack life being on an Army base. But there's a sort of surprise at the end where after the war, he really hits it big and gets his comeuppance against the sergeants who'd always harassed him.
Well, better than singing cats, I guess.
Exactly.
You must have had a chance to talk with some of the enlisted men and women in the show. Have any of them served in recent conflicts like Iraq or Afghanistan? And do the songs or any of the stories seem quaint and out of sync with the times we live in?
Well, there's a lot of the language that's sort of the argot of the time that isn't the way we speak in today. But, you know, the experience is still in very many ways the same experience. You know, there's an enormous amount of, you know, bureaucracy and sort of Byzantine rules and regulations that you're to follow. But then really, above all, I think just the camaraderie that people find when they're in a situation like that and in that kind of culture. And for the people, yeah, who have served recently, I think they really see their experience reflected in these in a really, really powerful way. And they've been really open and candid about sharing that with us, which has been incredible.
Sometimes when musicals are lost, they're lost for a reason. Does the music, the comedy hold up, do you think?
Oh, I mean, unbelievably. I mean, like I said, these guys were top shelf guys. It's very, very funny. And the songs are so tuneful. And it's clear that, you know, that if they had been heard, you know, some of these would be standards right up there with the rest of them by these guys who were writing hits like that.
Like what? So, what's a song that really pops out for you that might even be relevant today?
There's a song called Lost in a Cloud of Blue, and it's just a gorgeous, beautiful love song. It's a ballad that you could imagine Frank Sinatra crooning and driving people crazy with it.
Tom Ridgely of the Waterwell Theater Company is the director of the Blueprint Specials. The last performance of these lost Army musicals will be tomorrow on the hangar deck of the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum in New York. Thank you, Tom, very much, and break a leg.
Thanks so much.
We remember the reporter who first broke the news that World War II had started. That's coming up here on The World. President Obama's gearing up to give his farewell address in Chicago tonight, and President-elect Donald Trump is no doubt already preparing for his inaugural address in 10 days. Well, the new leader of Ghana may have some advice for Trump. Make sure your inauguration speech is thoroughly vetted. President Nana Akufo-Addo's own inaugural speech seems strangely familiar to some listeners. My BBC colleague David Amanor is from Ghana, and he heard the speech on Saturday. Here's how he describes it.
Well, at first, you know, lots of things were familiar and not so surprising. You know, at first listen, he acknowledged the visiting dignitaries, promises to improve the economy, to be a president for all, you know, being magnanimous in victory. What most of us didn't realize was that certain poetic clauses about citizenship and responsibilities had been said before, and not just by no one, but by former U.S. presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton.
Well, let's hear what his speech kind of sounded like. It's not just sort of sounds like a couple of old speeches by U.S. presidents. Here's a sample of Akufo-Addo's speech and George W. Bush's, and we can listen side by side.
I ask you to be citizens.
I ask you to be citizens.
Citizens, not spectators.
Citizens, not spectators.
Citizens, not subjects.
Citizens, not subjects.
Responsible citizens building communities of service and a nation of character.
Responsible citizens building your communities and our nation.
All right, slight variation there, but wow, that was pretty much to the word. What has been the response from President Akufo-Addo?
Well, from his team, there's kind of mixed signals coming. You know, for lots of the communication team, they're holding out saying, no, this wasn't plagiarism. This was just a mistake in not citing sources, so an oversight. So, you know, there's been a lot of fudging going on, but it can't really wipe off that embarrassment at the moment that such a thing should happen, that this president's speechwriters had lifted. I mean, it wasn't just close, was it? It was word for word. Yeah. And yours was an abridged version, by
right.
the way.
I mean, that's really splitting hairs. I mean, President Akufo-Addo, he studied at Oxford. He knows what plagiarism is. It is stealing. The Ghanaian public was pretty excited over his campaign. Has this incident dampened the excitement now?
In a way, it hasn't dampened excitement. In a way, it has overshadowed other aspects that probably would have been talked about in his speech. But what makes this stand out is, as you've rightly said, Nana Akufo-Addo is very well-educated, Oxford-educated, a lawyer by practice and a former attorney general. I mean, he is a bigwig in Ghanaian politics. And it's been a long time coming to this position. You know, his father was one of the independence leaders. His father was a ceremonial president. He's no lightweight politician. And he's probably the most well-educated and the most intellectual president we Ghanaians have had. And that should be a plus in some way, whether you liked him or not, whether you supported him or not. At least you'd say, well, this guy, you know, is intellectually above the rest. And no one, including myself, I admit, would have expected him to have a speechwriter who's basically copying and pasting stuff like that for somebody who's known, renowned for making very rousing speeches himself in all his political career, in all the fights he's had in the law courts and outside. You know, so, I mean, in that context, it's been quite an embarrassment for Ghanaians and particularly for President Akufo-Addo.
My BBC colleague David Amanor, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Finally today, we journalists all dream of being witnesses to history unfolding, of landing the big scoop. Well, that all came true for rookie British reporter Claire Hollingworth back in 1939. She was the one who broke the news of, well, she broke the news of World War II, and that would remain the scoop of the century. Claire Hollingworth died today at the age of 105. Janine DiGiovanni has herself been a war correspondent, and she reviewed Hollingworth's biography for The Spectator. So thanks for being with us to remember Claire Hollingworth. Janine, how did she land the scoop of the 20th century?
It was incredible, really. She basically spotted German forces that were amassed on the Polish border. She was in Poland, and by pure gumption, she convinced a diplomat friend of hers to give her, to loan her his car. And then she's crossed the border to Germany. And at the time, by the way, she had just joined the Daily Telegraph. I think she was 1 week or 2 weeks
right.
into her very first job as a journalist. And basically, she saw the tanks getting ready for a strike. And that was her first scoop, her first enormous scoop.
Pretty incredible.
Later she went on to, unbelievable that she did another one a few days later about the Nazis launching their invasion. She had started her career actually as a aid worker in Poland working with refugees, and she had very close relations with diplomats, and she used that. She was very charming, she was very cunning, but she was a great reporter.
So what was she doing as an aid worker? You said she was working with refugees.
It was quite interesting because it's a part of her life that not many people know at all. She had gone to Eastern Europe after she had a scholarship at London School of Slavonic Studies. And she went to Eastern Europe basically to begin working with refugees and displaced people. This is before the war. During the war itself, while she was a journalist, she continued moonlighting as an aid worker, helping to save the lives of many Jewish people, to try to get them out, get them papers. And she was doing this in a kind of underhanded way. I mean, she wasn't officially supposed to be doing it, but she was using, again, using her diplomatic contacts, using her nous, using her cunning to try to save the lives of many people. And in one instance, she actually took a refugee with her in the car and drove him as far as she could to get him to a border so that he could get to safety.
And she didn't just cover that German invasion of Poland. She became a war correspondent for the rest of her career. Where else did she work?
She worked in Vietnam. She worked all over the Middle East. She worked in Algeria. And later in her life, she went to live in Asia, and she became a real fixture at the Hong Kong Foreign Correspondents Club, which is a real legendary place for old correspondents of all kinds. And she had her own table there until, I mean, she just died today, 105 years old. She would go every day, sit there. She liked to have a beer for breakfast. And she always, apparently, the legend is that she still kept her bag and her shoes ready in case she had to go run to do a breaking news story.
And then after this intense life of work as a reporter, Claire Hollingworth was the victim of a pretty serious crime. What happened?
Yeah, it's still been unresolved. She was basically taken for a ride by a much younger man who befriended her and who somehow fleeced her out of her savings. She had somehow allowed him to take control of her estate, which really surprised so many people because she had been so savvy and so sharp. And yet at the end of her life, someone had taken such terrible advantage of her.
So to sum up, Janine, what does Claire Hollingworth mean to you?
Resilience, strength, curiosity, extraordinary woman, extraordinary life.
Janine DiGiovanni, Middle East editor at Newsweek in Paris, also the author of The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria. Janine, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
And that's our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.